Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Lee Carlo, joined as always by Chapin Hemingway and Jeremy Fisk. This week we'll be discussing Danny Boyle's new film, Yesterday, starring Himesh Patel and Lily James. Then we're going to top everything off today with our top five songs in movies. I think specifically sung by the characters in the movies. Is that correct, guys?
Yep.
Oh, no. Right. I thought we were making it broad.
Well, we can, but then I was like, hey, let's do this. We don't have to.
Well, mine all, the music is recognized by the characters in the movie. It's not necessarily
It's German diegetic. Did top five diegetic music in movies.
Yep,
pretty okay. much.
This was my last gig. If it has happened by now, it's like a miracle.
Miracles happen.
What happened?
Electricity flicked off all over the world.
Cheese!
Yesterday,
Ellie bought you a present.
All my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
John, Paul, George and Ringo, the Beatles.
No. Stop it.
Yesterday.
It's one of the greatest songs ever written.
Well, it's not Coldplay. It's not Fix You.
Okay, guys. So a while back, we did a top five for our most anticipated movies of 2019. I can't remember specifically which podcast that was on. But Yesterday was on my list.
Wasn't on Jeremy's too?
No, it was on mine. I don't think it was on Jeremy's. But either way, this is the first movie among the 15 movies that we collectively listed that we are reviewing here on the podcast. I think
it was on my list.
It was?
Yep.
Okay, so I think that's specifically interesting because, you know, while it was among, you know, our most anticipated movies of the year, it's gotten a lot of talk kind of on the periphery about anticipation, about people looking forward to this movie for one reason or another. And I think three specific things that we can point to are, of course, Danny Boyle being the director. I think we all like Danny Boyle. I don't know if we all share the same favorites among his, but I think we all like him as a director. Richard Curtis, while I don't know that everybody knows him specifically by name, they know his credits, both writing and directing.
Yeah, of course.
Notting Hill, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Love Actually, a lot of romantic comedies that are much beloved. And then, of course, the Beatles, arguably the most famous band in the history of the world. So it's drawn a lot of attention. Look what he did. Wouldn't that have been brilliant if you guys like decided to pretend that this band never existed?
Yeah, good idea for a movie.
So needless to say, those three things in particular, the Beatles, have gotten people interested in this movie. And I think, you know, that's great. In some cases, you know, you really can gather an audience with a high concept like this. But of course, just the Beatles in general. Chapin, you have sort of suggested casually to me that you're not all that familiar with the Beatles. You said you think you like their music, but you're not totally sure. Yeah. Jeremy, I believe you are a Beatles fan to a certain extent,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
I also really enjoy the Beatles. But
there you have it. We like the Beatles.
Outside of their music, though, like and maybe this will, you know, kind of get at what you were getting at, Chapin. I don't really have any relationship with the Beatles beyond their music. Like I don't, you know, the bigger picture of what the Beatles were. I mean, the Beatlemania part of pop culture came, you know, before our time. And I think that our generation, you know, we either like the music or we don't. We can't really relate to what was going on totally in the world when they came around and what their music was about and what they kind of did for everybody. And I bring all this up because it kind of led me to a question that I do want to get to, but it will reveal our opinions on the movie. So I want to table it for a second because I know that we try to avoid that a little bit. So I'll first ask you guys this. Well, we're exploring this world in this movie in which the Beatles never existed. And our star, Jack Malik, played by Himesh Patel, adopts their songs as his own and becomes famous as a result. Does this movie give us any deeper insight into either the music industry? Does it give us any deeper insight into relationships, into moral consciousness? Or is this movie just satisfied with its tagline or its kind of billboard review that says it's the fantastic feel-good movie of the summer?
I mean, I would say no. I thought it was interesting you brought up about when you were talking about our relationship with the Beatles and that we weren't really alive during all the sort of important things that happened around the Beatles that their music comments on and is influenced by, of course. And so that was kind of a, for me, a little bit in the film, I was a little dubious as to how popular these songs actually would be. I mean, the one thing I think that the film sort of relies on in just like sort of the plot, and I don't think the plot is terribly important to the filmmakers here, but I mean, regardless, it's the plot of the film, is that all these songs are just automatic hits just because they were hits when they came out, when the Beatles initially released them. And but I think that we don't really have a great sense of, you know, what it was like to be alive, you know, between 62 and 1975, whenever the Beatles were. I mean, they were only together for like 10 years, right, ultimately. But there was all these important things that happened during that time. And I think that had a lot to do with their success and what inspired them and then how it inspired other people. And I think that, you know, this is kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, but I guess my point being that, I mean, that part of the film just was sort of strange because I think, you know, that's what's so important about music, and especially in the Beatles, is that it's a reflection on and a reflection of society. And I just didn't find that. I mean, I sort of wondered, like, would these songs actually be the hits that they were without the sort of, you know, political slash kind of, you know, the things going on in culture around them?
I think the movie does try to address that a little bit. And I think some of the best scenes in the movie are when they're tackling like that problem. It's the first times he sings the songs after he's realized everybody but him that he knows of don't know who the Beatles are. And he's like the scene he's singing to his parents the very first time.
Right.
Or he sings Here Comes the Sun and they're just like, oh, that was nice. That was a cute son, you know, like, so they do kind of address those issues a bit, but I do agree that all of a sudden, once it takes off, it takes off, I think, a little bit too fast, and then the movie becomes about the only really plot point in that movie then becomes about whether he feels morally obligated to keep performing these songs, and I thought that was not a very interesting plot point.
Yeah, well, so that's so you guys sort of covered actually what was going to be my second question about, you know, does taking the plot out of this and the plot holes out of this, like, does this make sense that he would be super famous? Like, you know, there was a whole, you know, number of things going on in the world that made the Beatles famous besides their music, but, you know, I think you guys are right. The movie doesn't totally care about that, which is why, well, I ask, what does this movie care about? Is it telling us something deeper about like the music industry, or more? I think relationships are a big piece that this movie is trying to tackle, and you know what is important to us. And then the moral consciousness piece that you brought up, Jeremy. You know, does this movie give us anything deeper there, or is it all surface level?
Well, I don't think we or he should even care that much about that moral conscious decision. It's really not a big deal. Like, honestly, there's a moment where he finds out he's not alone in Earth, where there's a couple other people that knew who the Beatles were. And that's when I'm like, oh, boy.
Yeah, those were the stakes in the movie.
Yeah, those were the stakes. Things are going to get interesting maybe here. But they're just like, oh, so glad you're singing the songs. We love them. So, you know, for me, the movie, you asked what about this movie, like, kind of drew us into it, of the big sort of themes, whether it was the Beatles or Danny Boyle or the writer. But for me, it was honestly the concept. And I know it's sort of high concept idea, but I've always had this fantasy. Like, me and Chapin used to talk about, you know, what if, like, Raging Bull didn't exist, and then we could go and make Raging Bull. So, you know, it's just, it's a fun idea to play around with. And then taking the Beatles, something so iconic and something everybody knows, it's a way to get everybody else in on that, on the concept and have fun with it together. Whether they fully executed it, I don't think so. But I do love the idea of this film.
Yeah. So let's get into it, because you're right. This movie is a high concept, and honestly, that's it. I don't think they do anything with it. Like, they don't explain it. I mean, this movie is an exercise in plot holes. If anybody wants to take a course on what not to do, like, this is it, because they don't explain why anything happens. I mean, just to kind of recap how this movie gets going, we open on Jack Malik, who's a struggling songwriter.
Do you need an explanation of how this happens? Like, there's not going to be a real explanation.
But
like,
then
with that.
Okay, but then why did the lights go out? Why does the lights
cares?
Go out? Right. So why do it? Why film that?
Because
why? Like, he means, like, what is it? What's the difference if there's an explanation or not?
Yeah, it's just getting
to
the
point. Well,
then
that's part of the problem too. But
you just need to get to the point where he's the only one who knows the Beatles. I think the problem with this movie is it comes way after that part. The problem is with his rise to fame, the weird relationship that he has with modern pop stars in this, specifically Ed Sheeran, and the total miscasting of... oh my God! Now I can't remember her name.
Kate McKinnon.
Thank you. Who seems to be in a SNL skit the whole time? I think that's where the real issues come.
I don't know if it was her fault. I think that she could have been totally fine in it if they didn't make this like character so outrageous.
I think she did that. I think she added a lot of that didn't need to be there.
It could have been. And look, I agree that the problems with this movie come after the concept is introduced. And that's true. But I also think that what I'm suggesting with all these things about leading up to it are just like microcosms of the same problem. Like, this is a movie that takes a concept, a high concept, and does nothing with it. The lights going out all over the world at the same time with no explanation is also a high concept that has no explanation. Him getting hit by a bus at that exact moment and then waking up and the Beatles don't exist is a high concept that is never explained. And it really, they don't do anything with it, which is so frustrating. Because I think they're trying to make, and this might have a little bit to do with Richard Curtis being the writer, I think they're trying to make a love story here with the backdrop of this high concept, and they get caught somewhere in the middle of leaving the high concept to just suffice on its own and not really writing a good love story.
But what's,
I think what's
really interesting about that is that we all were, in one way, or you guys more than I was, but then once you brought the film up, I went and watched the trailer, and this looked like an incredibly interesting film. But then when you think about it, if you look back after having seen the film and say, well, yeah, this is a movie about a guy who is the only one in the world who knows the Beatles. And it's like, that's the concept, you know, like that's it. And it's in retrospect feels a little light, right? Like it's not.
Yeah. Right. Because what does he have to wrestle with after that?
Yeah.
I don't see the problem with him taking that credit for a band that didn't exist.
Totally.
It should be all about the love story after that. But it really, that gets lost in the shuffle of the concept too.
and you, I'm glad you brought up the two other people in the movie, which you've already spoiled, so I won't give a spoiler alert. But that it turns out also have heard of the Beatles, and they try to create some stakes here and give Jack a reason to feel like he's doing something wrong. And the movie does this intentionally. The movie tries to tell you as an audience member that these people are onto him, and they're going to you know, call him out on what he's doing. And then they just totally abandon that. And I think for laughs, is it what they were trying to do there? It just became a joke when they just say, like, oh, we just wanted to thank you because we can't sing and we're happy to be able to hear the Beatles songs again.
No, I don't think so. It's more of like a, it's more, you know, these things actually exist and there's a power in these songs beyond, you know, just that they were leading to money and fame. It's like these were beautiful works of art, and you know, this phenomenon happened where it erased it from everybody but three people on Earth, but they were three big fans of the Beatles, and they're glad that they exist in some form or the other. I don't think it was giving him an out, because I mean, the morality of the film ultimately, spoiler alert, is that he feels too guilty and that to keep going with his success, which, you know, we could argue one way or the other is the right or wrong way to go. But I think the morality of the film is that, you know, you shouldn't, I don't know, not steal people who, like, what, like, I don't know what
yeah.
the ultimate
yeah,
answer
I mean,
is,
but if you play this through, so if he feels so bad about this and then tells everybody that, no, he didn't write these songs, it's these four guys, that then everybody's like, who and what are they? Like, people would then be like, I don't get it. You're giving credit to a non-existent, you just might as well have made up four names.
Yeah. All right, so I want to get into this love story that I think we can all agree maybe is what this, well, definitely was the, you know, attempted through line here in terms of having our characters change. Like I said, Richard Curtis has done a lot of work in this genre with romantic comedies. I actually haven't seen a lot of his movies. Like, I've never seen Four Weddings and a Funeral or Notting Hill. Love Actually, I've seen many times, and I think, you know, while silly, it probably, I think it's at the very least is an above average romantic comedy.
Oh, I think it's really good.
But I think, you know, regardless of your feelings on romantic comedies or his movies in particular, he definitely has a knack for this. Like, he knows what to do to get people. I mean, he's written, you know, lines like I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love me, or that is in Notting Hill, that I think resonates with a lot of people that are fans of this genre. And he clearly tried to capture something similar here with Lily James' line being like, I've just been waiting for you to wake up one day and love me, but I'm just a school teacher, yada, yada, yada. And just none of it worked. Like, it was so bad, I thought. Like, I just did not care. I honestly, like, I don't really think any actor was bad in this movie. I mean, even Kate McKinnon, I just thought it wasn't totally her fault, but like Lily James, more than anybody, I just felt bad for in this movie. Like, she was given nothing to work with, and she had to like shoulder this whole relationship that Himesh Patel's character didn't care about either, as much as he tried to pretend.
Yeah,
he did.
It got to the point where I was like, they shouldn't be, like, it'd be better if they weren't together.
Right.
Like, it's like, I kept being like, let's just, you know, separate this. I don't get what you're doing. Like, what are you doing? You're now the most popular singer in the world. You clearly didn't like her before. Like, why throw that all away for a relationship?
He calls her his sister.
Yeah, for a relationship you'd never clearly wanted.
Yeah, and then when he does want it, he's like right in front of her boyfriend. She's like,
yeah, that was actually the best scene.
And he's just
guy,
like,
that guy's like, yeah, I figured that much.
Yeah. But I'm like, what happened here? Like, I don't understand. Like I said, I don't have a ton of experience with Richard Curtis, but I know this guy knows what he's doing.
Okay, but that's the thing I wish you had seen Notting Hill, because it's the same exact plot elements. Like,
does it work better?
No, yes, in Notting Hill it does, but it's the same concept. It's like, you know, the guy, I'm sorry, you brought him up, Lee, a couple podcasts ago, but the guy that, the weird Welsh guy, Reese Infins or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Like he is the analog for him is the black roadie guy, you know, like the weirdo. Yeah. And then he's got this group of friends who are all kind of like, you know, dorky English people, and they're very, you know, conscious of their dorkiness. And it's, and he's got like a lot of platonic women friends who want to be, who, you know, eventually become romantically interested. It's like the same beats. It's like the exact, and that's fine. I mean, the thing is like, I was enjoying this film, right? Like I was, my heart was warmed, you know, shall we say, but ultimately, like, so what, you know, like, you feel good, but like, I've seen this done by him in two or three other movies. And the whole point, you made it clear in your intro, Lee, is like this concept was interesting to us for some reason.
Yeah,
nothing was done with it.
I felt the same way. I wanted this to work so bad. I gave it a lot of benefit of the doubt, and I did enjoy. There were times where I was laughing and enjoying it, and just going with it. I knew from the beginning I was going to try to go with it, but there were points in this movie that made it really, really hard for me to do that. One of them is I didn't believe the relationship. The other one is I didn't find his, moral sticking situation to be particularly that bad. And the third, spoiler alert, was when he went and visited John Lennon, who happens to still be alive, because why would this guy not let this random guy into his house to talk about something he never invented and learn some wise life lessons at that time? That was, really bothered me.
That was simultaneously like the most interesting and most frustrating moment in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Because it was another... I get it's a little different, but it's another high concept piece. It's like, oh, the Beatles never existed. So wait a second, John Lennon is still alive. Like that. So, and that's literally what I felt like that scene was there for. They opened the door, and literally, so I was in a theater with people that were laughing and enjoying, and at one point started to, and thank Christ they stopped clapping along with the fucking music. And
they don't know how close they came to losing their lives in that movie theater.
So, like, I had people that were fully invested in this movie, and then when John Lennon opened the door, they groaned.
Oh, so, really? So they were just like, oh, boy, that's too much.
I think it was too much. And
it definitely was.
So I feel like that, you're right, like, that was a piece that you just had a really hard time buying into.
Although Sarah overheard somebody saying, is that what he looks like now?
Oh, my God. I mean, they did find a good actor for that.
You know who that was? Robert Carlyle.
Who? What is he in?
He's from the Full Monty and Trainspotting and.
Oh right, all the other British films. Oh yeah, look. Oh yeah, that's right. I never see. He looks so much younger in everything else I've ever seen him in.
Well, yeah, they're making him look like old John Lennon.
Right.
But hold on a second. The one thing I do want to say about that scene is I think that's what's frustrating about the concept. Look, this is a Richard Curtis movie. It's going to be a romantic comedy. We understand that. But you're right. This is a high concept film. And like, that would be an interesting opportunity to like explore, a little bit of a higher element here. Right. Like, I mean, we leave that scene like, you know, getting sort of focused back on the romance. He says, oh yeah, I found my love, or I was happily married. We don't understand, like, was that ultimately to Yoko Ono? I mean, who was that person?
They really like try to tease that.
But what an opportunity to say, like, the music was obviously very important to this man. And was he just not, people forgot the Beatles song, but does that mean that like,
did he never write them?
Did he never write them?
Does that mean he doesn't like music?
Was he never a musician? Like, what did he do? Like, what? And I don't know. I think that to me, that's the biggest issue with this film. It's what drew us in, was that it never did anything interesting with this concept. It was just like,
it had a lot of opportunities.
Yeah. And
it had that, the music industry piece with Kate McKinnon. Like, you know, that, like, him being sort of a nobody that doesn't understand the music industry writes all these great songs, and then they kind of, like, she jokes about it, like, oh, we, you know, then we take all your money. But, like, what if there is, like, some truth to that, and they explore that?
Yeah, but why does she need to be so over the top with everything?
Well, that's how they like, yeah.
Yeah, they butchered that aspect of it. I think it just got lost in the weight of itself. It forgot what it really was, and that, and it tried to do too many things, and then it couldn't make, like, the important stuff work, like the romantic story element work, because he had to go and see John Lennon, and he had to have, you know, issues with should he or should he not sing these songs. And, like, it just became all too much, and none of it was addressed in a deep enough way to make any of it relatively important.
Yeah, I mean, it ultimately, the romance didn't even have anything to do with the plot of the film. I mean, you could have had the same, their romantic entanglement and the issues they had with each other were more about the fact that he, I mean, you know, kind of the, this was a platonic relationship that was sort of one-sided for most of their life. And, you know, that had nothing to do with the fact that he now knows the Beatles songs. Like, I mean, she was his manager, but that never had anything to do with them breaking up or coming back together. Yeah. It was just
separate story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to see this portrayed in a bit more realistic fashion. I know that sounds crazy because it's, you know, about a guy who all of a sudden is the only one that knows the Beatles. But what if that really happened? I wanted to see that movie.
Okay. So that brings me to one of my last two things I want to discuss, and that's Danny Boyle's direction here. Are you guys familiar with this Danny Boyle? I mean,
no.
It was like, I made a couple notes. There was a couple times I'm like, okay, Danny Boyle's deciding to do something. Nothing interesting, but there was a time he was following, I think, our main character, and the camera was, you know, a bit askew, for no reason. He was falling through. It was
a bunch of Dutch angles.
Of Dutch angles for no reason. It didn't really add anything. Or they were having a conversation and he jumped the 180 degree line a bunch of times. And it was just off-putting, but it was like Danny
Enough
Boyle
to remind
saying,
you to someone behind the camera,
saying, hey, I'm directing this. I got to do something. And it was, none of them added anything to the film. If anything, it took away, it was a distraction from it. But yeah, Danny Boyle, I don't know. It was like, he couldn't figure out how to get his auteurism into this movie. And so he just kind of played it straight.
Yeah, it was... I left thinking, I was like, okay, Danny Boyle's a huge Beatles fan and read this script and was like, hey, I'll do it. Like, that's what this felt like to me, because the content wasn't his really either. Like, it's not his material.
Yeah. I mean, it's even if he's the world's greatest Beatles fan, like, is this movie about the Beatles? No, it's not even about the Beatles.
No, but that's why everybody went to see it. And that's why, like, that seems to be what the biggest takeaway for everything. The majority of the articles written and the conversation surrounding this movie is, what would you miss most about if the Beatles were gone? Did this work? Would he be successful? Chapin, you brought this up. Would he be successful if he just sang Beatles songs with, you know, the time period and all the other aspects of the world notwithstanding? So that's the conversation, and that's what this movie is, whether it wants to be or not.
We were toying with our top fives, I had to admit to you guys that I don't really, the Beatles are kind of a blind spot for me, but I'm interested in them, as, you know, as being like probably the most important musicians ever to have lived. And, I'm interested in how you look at their appearance, and from 1964 to 1974, they go from being these clean cut English boys to these, you know, hippies. And the most influential band in the world, and there's the you know, Lennon McCartney thing, and I guess I listened to another podcast on this film, and I guess these are mostly Paul songs, but I thought they like wrote all their songs together, and I'm not really sure what that means. But I'm interested in that. But this movie gave me no more insight into the Beatles, who the Beatles were, or how important they were.
Well, I think a super interesting question would be if you take this concept and reverse it in a weird way, and you had somebody who had never heard of the Beatles or didn't know any of their songs watch this film, how would the Beatles come across to them?
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Would they come across as, I get it, that's clearly the most important singer-songwriters of our time, other than David Brent? Or would they be like, I don't see it. I don't see the appeal here. What's happening?
I mean, you guys may feel differently, but this is the final piece that I wanted to talk about. And if that situation arose in someone who never knew the Beatles music and watched this movie, how would they be influenced by it, or how would they feel about it? And I feel like they wouldn't feel anything, because I thought the music was so poorly executed. Like, Jeremy, you told me you watched Across the Universe after this. I went back and rewatched it too, in anticipation for this. And I knew I didn't love that movie. I remembered not loving Across the Universe, and I clearly didn't love this movie. But at the very least, I like listening to the Beatles, and I like listening to their songs, and having them sort of reimagined in a way is kind of cool too. And I just felt like this movie didn't bring any energy to that either. Like, the back in the USSR scene when he's in Russia, I thought was the best, you know, quote unquote concert scene in the movie. But like, it was so dull sometimes.
I agree. And I think like that's what Across the Universe did better than this, is at least they put some effort into displaying the music.
Yeah.
Because it's a bunch of their songs intertwined to make that plot for Across the Universe. And at least you knew you got another Beatles song coming up, whether or not the interconnection of the plot really worked. You could at least enjoy that. Whereas you're right. And I'm, you know, thinking about it now for the first time since you brought it up, but he wasn't maybe the right guy to sell it.
Yeah, it's true. Himesh Patel from EastEnders.
Is he?
So,
yeah, I was hoping. I mean, I know nothing about that show. I didn't even realize until I was looking him up that EastEnders has been running for like 30 something years.
It's a British soap opera, sure.
But I wanted so badly for him to be the guy that plays Ricky. Ricky, no, leave it.
I liked his performance a lot. I thought he was really good, and I think he's got a long career ahead of him. But I was thinking, after getting out of the movie, like what it was like for him to make this film, you know. And I just imagined him just days and days and days making that like kind of confused "what's going on" expression.
Yeah.
All day long, 12 hours a day. Like that seemed to be his one. One emotion, like just you know, like kind of mouth agape, and you know, I don't know. I think this film was like a platform for a lot of creative, good people, but just oof.
Yeah, I mean, there was one little note I had that I think would have helped improve it, is instead of that couple who gave him the lead to where John Lennon lived, if they had given him the rest of the lyrics to Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
I thought that would have been a nice touch, but instead they took it off in this very bizarre direction. And then what'd you guys think of Ed Sheeran in this?
So I actually liked him. But his scenes were some of the worst.
Evidently, like, that was supposed to be Chris Martin from Coldplay.
Ah, that would have been better.
Really?
Yeah, because they made the Coldplay joke earlier.
Well, it's not Coldplay.
Yeah, it's not Fix You. I thought he was funny, and I actually thought he performed admirably. But I hated his scenes. The song write-off that they do, where they both take 10 minutes and write a song. This was another example of butchering the Beatles songs. Jack plays "The Long and Winding Road," amazing song, and of course Ed Sheeran then says, "That's the greatest song I've ever heard. You win, no vote." And what's supposed to be this like really great, poignant moment, But I was like, that was an okay rendition of The Long and Winding Road. I was just it just didn't work. Like, I just felt like it, I don't know, it didn't work. But I thought Ed Sheeran was fine.
Well, there you go. I don't think we all loved it.
We didn't quite recommend this one.
No.
Too bad. I mean, I would like them to do a movie like this again. Another shot at it. Same concept. It doesn't have to be the Beatles. It could be a great director. It could be whatever, you know?
Maybe don't make it a comedy. Go darker with it.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah. And if you're going to have somebody like Danny Boyle direct it, definitely go darker with it. There's no reason not to. I wonder how much weight the families in the States of or the Beatles themselves, who are still alive, had on this.
Well, it cost them $10 million to get the rights to the song, which seems to be about half the budget of the film.
Jeez. So once they give them the rights, they can do it however they want. Like, they could.
I'm sure that there's a lot of restriction as to how they can do it.
But I wonder if that's kind of why this was more of an upbeat love story than a darker.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting. I think, you know, we obviously Rocket Man just came out, and last year, much to many people's chagrin, the Bohemian Rhapsody was a huge hit and a big contender at the Oscars. And, you know, I think a big criticism with that film was that, you know, it was they were very much working with the living members of Queen, and who are very protective of Freddie Mercury's image, and so that film couldn't be interesting. It couldn't be a real look at what that was like, you know, for better or worse. And so you get this kind of washed down, watered down, sycophantic look at the people. So do you guys want me to confess to you my little thing I was talking to you about that I was teasing on the text?
Yes.
It kind of relates to this. So I rewatched War Horse, which was
War Horse.
Oh my god, it's so funny! I almost rewatched that the other day. I was like, "Oh, it's streaming."
Conveniently written by Richard Curtis, who also wrote
really?
This film. Yep, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Really,
I did.
Have you listened? I re-listened to that podcast recently.
It was bad.
We destroyed this movie.
Yeah, we destroyed it. And look, I mean. It's not one of my favorite films of all time. It's certainly not even one of my favorite Spielberg films of all time. But man, it's a little saccharine, I will admit. It's a little, you know, it's a little mushy, but it is gorgeous. And just like in the way that Spielberg knows how to shoot those dinosaurs and knew how to shoot the animatronics. Yeah, the Nazis too. Animatronic shark and Jaws. Like they just get amazing things. This horse is like the star of the film, and like they
But do you hear yourself? This is the problem with the movie.
No, I know, but it was really good. I challenged the two of you to go back and watch it, and I challenge you to disagree with me.
All right.
It
has been thrown down.
Yeah. I really like it.
I have to watch Chernobyl two or three more times before I can get that War Horse.
Right now, it's my great, great pleasure to introduce Sonic Death Monkey. I'm an idiot. I should have played the whole album first. These people are going to burn the place down. Rob, thank you for the enthusiastic intro, but we're no longer called Sonic Death Monkey. We're on the verge of being called Kathleen Turner Overdrive. However, this evening we will be Barry Jive and the Uptown Five.
So, moving on to our top five, inspired by Yesterday, we are doing top five songs in movies. Chapin and I decided to do songs sung specifically by the characters in movies. Jeremy went with the broad category of top five diegetic songs in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jeremy should have plenty to choose from and plenty to cover any potential repeats, so we'll let him go last. Chapin, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. I will definitely do that. My number five is going to be the first thing I thought of, and a scene that I absolutely love, and that's when Adam Scott and I'm sorry, who is that other woman in Step Brothers? Excuse me, as I look this up, are singing "Sweet Child of Mine" in Step Brothers. Catherine Hahn.
Scene.
So Adam Scott plays the sort of the dickhead brother. John C. or Will Ferrell, or they're like coming home from a dinner that we just saw, and it's Adam Scott, Catherine Hahn, and their two kids, and they are singing a cappella "Sweet Child of Mine."
And they're like great at it.
They're really, really good. And then he just attacks Catherine Hahn for being a little flat. And oh my God, it's just, I mean, that character like made that film for me, the Adam Scott character. And it's especially interesting to see him, because that was my introduction to Adam Scott, was this, you know, asshole character from the film. And now he's playing this kind of dorky, you know, guy in the Big Little Lies, which I'm also really enjoying. And I haven't started the second season yet. Such a funny scene. And it's just those random sort of what's his name movies, Will Ferrell movies. You know, the Adam McKay stuff, that I wasn't crazy about that stuff, but I love this movie so much just because they were so good at like finding those weird random moments to insert into the movie. So that's my number five. Sorry, it's a little long-winded.
All right. My number five comes from a much more serious film. It's the end of Full Metal Jacket, when they're all marching, singing, of all things, Mickey Mouse Club.
Hmm.
Which, I don't know. First of all, that shot is beautiful, and the irony of it just is great. I think a great way to end that movie.
I have to revisit that movie. I almost remember nothing from it.
Even D'Onofrio in the bathroom with his...
No, that's pretty much all I remember.
Yeah. Scared the living daylights out of me when I watched that at a way too young age.
Jesus.
My dad's like, this movie really is the most realistic war movie. We're watching this.
You're like, all right, oh my Pop. God. All right. Well, I'm calling this my almost famous memorial list. Because it would have probably had the top two. And okay, also to get it out of the way, this is the only one of the top five that I don't think the characters are singing to the song, but they're at least interacting and dancing with the song. So we'll do that. And that is the Sister Christian bit in Boogie Nights.
Oh yeah, very good. Such a good scene.
I
mean, he sings a little bit of it.
So there you go. Then my top five, same.
Singing along to it, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's a great one. I considered it. We talk about that scene so much because it's amazing.
All right, Chapin, what do you got? Okay, for
let's see. Okay, my number four is that scene, is the Tiny Dancer scene from Almost Famous. I think this is a film that I hope, you know, as part of our, maybe we can continue our 20th anniversary series into next year, and we can look at 2000 films from 2000, which I think was nearly as good a year, and Almost Famous came out at that time. I think this is sort of like the best moment in that film, or at least captures what I sort of like the most about that film, is the sort of really tender, sweet moments that that Cameron Crowe can capture really well. You know, a lot of his movies, for me at least, have gone way, way overboard with that stuff. But I think this is a really nice moment that comes at such a perfect time in that film, where the whole band and everybody who's with them are on the tour bus and break into singing Tiny Dancer.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any movie that you wanted yesterday to be like, It's Almost Famous. I mean, I think it's a perfect, if you want a movie to be like a perfect example of like a love letter to popular music, Almost Famous does that perfectly.
And mixing comedy with some darker themes and like, yeah, the tone of Almost Famous is, I think, maybe what you were hoping a little bit for too, Jeremy.
Yeah.
All right, my number four is from a movie we talk about all the time, but we never bring this scene up. It's a quick little bit, but I think it's hilarious, and it's Michael Cera and Superbad singing These Eyes.
Oh, that's a great pick. Yes.
Also, like a horrible voice, but like oddly good at it.
Yeah, no, that's a great scene. All right, what are we at? My number four.
Yeah, babes.
It's sort of the obvious one, but I had to add it. It's the Johnny B. Goode scene from Back to the Future.
Ah, you bastard. That's a great one.
Yeah, I mean, it's another one where you're playing with timelines where a song doesn't exist, and you're the first to play it. But somehow in this timeline, it gets back to him via a phone call of the last like 30 seconds of the song.
Yeah, when he calls Chuck Berry.
Yeah, yeah. He's got to listen to this.
Yeah.
And he just holds the phone out, and then apparently he had all the information he needed at that point to write it again.
I had to look up, because I know Michael J. Fox doesn't actually sing it. There's a guy named Mark Campbell is who dubbed it for Back to the Future. All right, Chapin.
All right. My number three is the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And it's the song they sing, but now I'm forgetting what that song is.
I can picture
Man of Constant Sorrow.
Yep.
That's a movie I really need to see again.
I mean, such a good movie, but also just, that song is so pivotal to the plot of the film, but also I can very distinctly remember the first time I heard that like beautiful sort of, scratchy old timey voice coming out of George Clooney. And it was so, just did not seem right. And I just remember laughing out loud when that happened. It was just such a beautiful voice coming out of of a guy who clearly can't sing. And oh my God, it was so funny.
That's a great pick.
Okay. My number three, this is a scene that I actually with someone performed in an audition for a play in high school.
You did?
Yeah, I did. It is Tom Cruise and Anthony Edwards, Goose and Maverick, singing You've Lost That Love and Feeling to Kelly McGillis.
It's a great pick. Can you give us a little bit now?
Nope. Those days are behind me.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't remember the words.
Ode to Tom Cruise, who cannot sing and still seems to get through that song.
And pulls it off.
Yeah.
And gets the girl.
Cool. I don't know that he pulls it off, but...
Well, he gets the girl. So it worked. So I've been trying it for... I keep doing that to strange women.
All right. Well, there you go. All right. My number three is... It's a very quick scene. It's the "Show Me the Way to Go Home" Jaws scene.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Just three men singing. Show me the way to go home.
I'm tired and I want to go to bed.
Go to the bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago and it went straight to my head. Doot, doot, and then Jaws hits the boat.
Yeah. Yep. I didn't even think about that. Great pick.
All right.
Okay, my number two is from a much better romantic comedy than Yesterday, and that's the scene from My Best Friend's Wedding when they sing "Say a Little Prayer for You."
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's always fun when it's hard not to like a scene when people start singing together. The building sings song sequence is a pretty popular one in.
Was that Richard? That was Richard Curtis too, right?
No, no.
Oh, it wasn't.
No.
Okay. There we go. Wrong.
All right. My number two. So it's interesting that I realized this as I was putting my list together, that this song is pretty famously sung by characters in two different movies, I'm going with the version in The Deer Hunter, Can't Take My Eyes Off of You.
Oh, that's a great, yeah, I wish
I thought of that. But also sung, probably even more famously, in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah, no, that would definitely have made my list had I thought of that.
I love that scene.
What song is it again they sing?
You're just too good to
be right,
true.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
Can't take my eyes off of you.
Yeah.
I love you, baby. Just like that.
A movie like that we disagreed on our our review. All right, we are number twos. Okay, my number two was I don't know if I've probably seen this movie one more time since I originally saw it, but I just will never forget this scene. And I watched this scene online since then, because it's just so haunting and in a weird way a bit beautiful, but really haunting. And it's Blue Velvet, when they're singing Roy Orbison's In Dreams.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I gotta see it.
Just watch that one scene and you'll be like, what? David Lynch at his best. It's frightening.
It's a fucked up movie.
It is, but that there's something about the way that between that music and the look, and it's just, there's something that just works there.
Is it my turn?
All right, Javen, okay. Number ones.
So my number one is also Full Metal Jacket, but it's the scene where they sing, "This is my rifle, this is my gun."
Yeah.
And they grab their dicks. I just like, I mean, we've talked about that film and it came up on our last week on our slow motion top five. And I just feel like I just don't really think the sequences in Vietnam are that special. I think we probably disagree about that, but I just love the Paris Island stuff. I think that's just an amazing that film turned out that way. And I love all those stuff with Arlie, Ermy, and especially that scene.
So I agree that the Paris Island sequences or half of the movie is the more interesting piece. I have grown to like the Vietnam parts more more I see it. For a long time, like, it was honestly a movie where I would watch the first half and I just wasn't interested in the second half. So I do agree with you to a certain extent. All right, my number one, I've kind of going back and forth here. And I'm going to probably upset Chapin with my pick of Magnolia and Wise Up.
Ah, great pick. I just saw Amy Mann in concert 2 nights ago.
And you guys all sang along with it.
And she didn't play this song, but she did play One is the Loneliest Number and Save Me.
Missed opportunity there.
Save Me, I like that song better. But the Wise Up scene, like, look, like, we talked quite a bit about this on the PTA retrospective, so I won't go on too much about it, but there's just something about that scene and the mood of it and kind of how the movie just sort of stops in place for that stretch, and it's just lovely.
I like that sequence. I didn't have a problem with it, especially this on the most recent revisit for the PTA retrospective. I liked it. And I also don't mind the frogs either, you know. That's not the problems I have with those movies. They're not the more ridiculous moments.
Right. All right, Jeremy.
All right. My number one, no surprise. At a certain point, we've got to stop me from using this movie anymore. But it is the As Time Goes By sequence in Casablanca.
Yeah.
I mean, we can make a rule. No more Casablanca for me.
We can't do.
Yeah. But it is. I mean, I probably would have had Tiny Dancer sequence maybe higher had I not put Almost Famous, but
I think I've had a bunch of Casablancas as well. Maybe
it might be
all,
one we just have to put away.
It's just, there's obviously two scenes in the film where he sings it. Well, more than two scenes, but two in particular. When she asks him to play it, and then when he gets really pissed that he played it, and so he asks him to play it as well.
Play it again, just so I can get drunk to this.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there you go. There's my my number one.
Okay, so that will wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We hope that you enjoyed our scathing review of Danny Boyle's Yesterday and our amazing top five diegetic songs / songs sung by characters. Please email us feedback at getyourfilmfixpodcast.com. Check us out on Instagram and Facebook. Do we have any other platforms in which people can reach out to us?
Nope. Leave a comment or we'd love a review on iTunes.
Yeah, that would be great. We'd love that. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.